rug, then lowering my forehead to touch my knees. "I see London, I see France," she's unable to resist. I reply with a faint groan. "What have you eaten today?" she asks, sitting beside me and reaching over to rub my back in small, soothing circles. "Just kale juice and a little black coffee," I confess. "That's it?" Sydney says, aghast. She pulls a power bar out of her bottomless bag. "Here, eat this. At least take a few bites." "I can't," I say, refusing it. "I'd rather pass out than puke." "Good point. Puking would be mortifying," she lets out a laugh. "Can you imagine?"
"Sydney, that's not helping," I say, feeling kale rise in my throat.
Sorry, you're right," she says. "Just breathe, honey. In through your nose, out through your mouth." She demonstrates and I follow her lead, the oxygen expanding my lungs and lowering my heart rate. "What time is it?" I ask after a few minutes of silence.
"Almost 6:30. They'll be coming down soon." She's referring to all the parents, but I only picture Will and Andrea, who right now might as well be the royal Will and Kate.
"You gonna be okay?"
I peer up at her and nod.
"I think so."
"Just remember," Sydney says, "she doesn't know you're single, and neither does he."
I nod again, thinking of how often I'm told that men can, in fact, sense when you're desperate. But maybe that doesn't apply to married ones who have already dumped you. Besides, I'm no longer desperate, I remind myself. I have a game plan, finally, which I've already confided in Sydney, too.
"And remember, you only have to get through the next hour or so," she says, grabbing my hands and pulling me to my feet.
"No," I say, shaking my head. "I have to get through the next 9 months." Sydney's eyes widen, her thick fake lashes at attention.
"What? Wait, are you already pregnant? Is that why you're sick?"
"No, dummy. I meant I have to get through the school year," I say.
"Oh, you will, no problem," she says. "Just stand up straight and smile and wipe the lipstick off your front tooth."
I rub my teeth with my finger and thank her, wishing she were my sister. Hell, if that were the case, I'd actually be the responsible one in the family. On her way to the door, she glances over her shoulder, gives me a thumbs up, and says,
"No matter what happens, that dress was a great fucking call."
Over the next 10 minutes, my classroom quickly fills with parents filing in two by two. Meanwhile, I focus on breathing and smiling, scanning name tags, and shaking hands. Once I have that down, I graduate to autopilot small talk, working the room like it's a cocktail party minus the flattering lighting, music, and cocktails.
"Hello, welcome. It's so nice to meet you. You're Lucy's mother. My goodness, I see the resemblance. The summer sure did fly by. I'm so excited for the school year."
As the last few stragglers enter and the slightly slow wall clock over the dry erase board clicks to 6:45, Will and Andrea have yet to arrive, and I start to become hopeful that they won't be coming at all. It could happen. Maybe they had a previous engagement. Maybe one or both had a non-life-threatening but contagious and unsightly illness, like, say, hand-foot-and-mouth disease or pink eye. Maybe, just maybe, they got into a huge fight over me. One could hope, I thought, as I tried to imagine the accusatory eruption on their way out the door.
"You still have feelings for her, don't you?"
"No, I swear I don't."
"Then why are you wearing cologne?"
Whatever the explanation, though, it is time to get started. Tugging nervously at the hem of my dress, I clear my throat and say hello, my smile feeling frozen. The room instantly quiets, everyone on their best behavior. The Pavlovian response to being back in a classroom, no matter what your age.
"Welcome! Welcome, everyone!"
My voice sounds unnaturally high, like that of a sorority rush chair who had just downed a Red Bull. I swallow, making a concerted effort to lower my voice an octave, along with my eyebrows, which feel maniacally raised.
"Thank you so much for being here tonight," I continue, sounding a bit more normal.
I glance at the door, praying that it doesn't open, and move on with my script. It's only been a couple weeks, and already I can tell what a wonderful group this is.
It's been such a pleasure getting to know your children, and I'm thrilled to meet you all. This evening, I'm going to briefly go through the curriculum for the school year, some of the fun things we're going to cover in reading and math, as well as our specials, which include science and social studies. Please take this opportunity to explore the classroom, visit your child's cubby, perhaps leave him or her a little note for tomorrow, and of course, feel free to ask any questions you may have. Remember, as I tell your children, there are no stupid questions, and my door is always, always open. Then, as my Charlie Brown teacher voice drones on, it happens. The door swings open, and in walk Andrea and Will. As everyone turns to look at the latecomers, I make the shocking observation that the perfect couple is not only late, but also flustered and slightly out of breath. At least she is. I won't let myself look directly at him. Andrea still qualifies as beautiful, but to my relief, she isn't quite as perfect as I remember from my Whole Foods sighting. She has gained a few pounds, and her hair is overdue for color, a dull brown stripe streaked with gray at the crown of her otherwise golden head. More satisfying are the sweat-soaked armholes of her marigold yellow silk blouse. Rookie move wearing silk on a day as hot as this one, I think, as she makes furtive eye contact with me and whispers, "Sorry, we're late." I wave off her apology with the same magnanimous smile I'd give to a child who had just wet his pants, which still occasionally happens in the first grade. "You're totally fine," I say, my heart fluttering in my chest, my role as scorned ex-girlfriend suddenly supplanted by my position as poised, punctual, and most forgiving educator. An hour later, the exhausting dog and pony show is finally over, and I make an announcement that everyone can head toward the auditorium unless they have any remaining questions. After a mass exodus, only two pairs of parents remain. One, the Edelmans, who have asked roughly 60% of all questions tonight, most of which are completely specific to their child, Jared, who, we have all learned, has a nut allergy, a latex allergy, a phobia of birds, and a propensity for nosebleeds. And two, Will and Andrea. I take a deep breath and address the Edelmans, who give me a 3-minute monologue about Jared's EpiPen, while from the corner of my eye, I watch Andrea and Will inspect Edie's cubby. I nod earnestly, reassuring the Edelmans that I'm very well versed in life-threatening allergies, but also fully confident that parents will respect the strict no-nut policy. "We are very, very careful," I say, acknowledging their concern. "Please rest assured that Jared will be safe at school." Finally appeased, the Edelmans thank me and move along, leaving only Will and Andrea. My heart is in my throat as I turn to them. "Hello," I say, my fake smile back in full force. I focus solely on Andrea, glancing at her gray roots, feeling grateful that I've yet to find one on my own head. A small victory. "Hi, Josie. I just wanted to introduce myself. I'm Andrea," she says. She gives me a genuine smile as she starts to shake my hand, then stops, perhaps because her hands are as clammy as mine. I take a deep breath and tell Andrea that it's very nice to meet her, too. At this point, I decide that I can no longer delay making eye contact with Will, so I force myself to meet his gaze. I feel a stab of pain in my chest. He is as perfect as I remember, even more so. "Hi, Will," I say. "It's nice to see you."
"Hi, Josie," he says.
I drop my gaze to the two open buttons of his teal-checked Vineyard Vines shirt and remember how soft his chest hair used to feel against me when we were making love. "It's been a while," I say, my eyes shifting to the whale logo on the breast pocket.
"Yeah," he says, nodding. "How's your family?"
"They're well. My parents are still divorced," I stammer. "But both are pretty happy. Meredith married Nolan, and they have a daughter." Will nods and says yes, he heard that. And I give him credit for not pretending that I hadn't crossed his mind once in a while all these years, and that he knew nothing about my life. He glances at Andrea and quickly explains,
"Nolan was Josie's brother's best friend."
She nods, clearly aware of exactly who all the players are, and oddly, I'm both touched and annoyed by this. On the one hand, How dare he talk about my brother to her, especially when he'd never even met him? And yet, deep down, I know I'd feel worse if Andrea had no clue who Daniel was.
That's really cool that they got married,
Will says, shifting his weight from one foot to the other, perhaps second-guessing his use of the word cool.
Is it really cool when two people connected to a terrible tragedy wind up together? I mean, it'd be cool if Daniel were still alive, but he's not.
I let Will off the hook and quickly agree, though, because I don't want to talk more about my sister's marriage or my brother's death. In case this isn't clear, I make my face as blank as possible, a tough thing to do when you're churning with emotion, but something I've become good at over the years. Impassive, I remember Will calling me during our final fight, a charge that led to me shutting down completely.
So anyway, we just wanted to say hello, Andrea says,
because otherwise it might be sort of awkward, given your history with Will. She chooses her words carefully.
I mean, I guess we just wanted to acknowledge the elephant in the room.
Yes. Thank you. I murmur, surprised by what appears to be her complete lack of an agenda, aside from pleasantness, courtesy, perhaps even kindness. Andrea smiles.
We were so happy when we got the teacher assignments. We heard that you're the best teacher in the grade.
All the first grade teachers are fantastic, I say, but I was happy to see Edie on my list, too. The statement suddenly doesn't seem like a lie, if only because she really has been the catalyst for my life-changing plan.
She really likes you, Andrea says. She talks about you all the time.
I'm not sure I believe this until Will nods in vague agreement.
Yeah, we heard about your doctor boyfriend in Africa.
He flashes me a fleeting look of skepticism that I could only interpret because I once knew him so well. He clearly doubts my story. Deciding I no longer need a Jack in my life, I give a little dismissive wave of my hand and say,
Oh yes, Jack, we actually broke up last night. Well, it was morning for him.
Oh, Andrea says with genuine concern. I'm sorry to hear that.
Long distance, it was inevitable. But I think we'll stay friends, I babble, trying to make my story more believable.
Andrea nods.
Yes, it's always nice if you can stay friends, she says, then glances at Will uneasily.
Or not, I say cheerfully, throwing her a lifeline.
Or not, Will echoes with a nervous chuckle.
After seeing Will, I experience a brief setback, granting myself a few days of self-pity and regret. But I remind myself that motherhood is what matters most to me, and that once I have a baby, I won't want to change a single thing about my past, including the fact that I lost Will, because all those steps will have been what led me to my child. I just have to get on with things. So that Friday night, I throw myself back into my research, surfing a reputable sperm donor site. I've yet to submit my credit card information and pay for full access to the database. I just want to get my feet wet. As I read, I started thinking about other women in my shoes, as well as married couples who are here because the husband's sperm isn't good. Somehow it helps to remember that I'm not the only one in this boat, and I tell myself to just take it one step at a time. Do I care about eye color? I blurt out to Gabe at one point as I go through the menu of genetic options, making selections just for the hell of it.
I don't know. Do you?
He asks with a yawn. He is reclined on the sofa, his feet propped up on two pillows. Well, I prefer brown-eyed guys, I say, but I'm not dating the guy, and I think I'd rather my child have my eye color.
Narcissist, he says.
I'm not a narcissist, I say. It's just, all things being equal, it might be nice if she looked like me.
She?
Or he. For some reason I picture a girl, I say, standing to refill my mug of coffee from the stale pot left over from this morning, then making a mental note to cut back on caffeine, starting tomorrow. I sit back down at the kitchen table, click the blue eye box, summarizing aloud for Gabe. Okay, so this is what I have so far. Caucasian, brown hair, blue eyes, medium or medium dark skin tone.
Why not fair-skinned?
He asks.
because she'll be less likely to burn and therefore less likely to get skin cancer.
All right, Gabe says, sitting up and stretching. I buy that.
Okay, next, ethnic background. I continue scanning the continents and choices as I check all the Eastern and Western European boxes, from Austrian and Belgian to Finnish and French to Scottish and Slovak, with a running commentary to Gabe as I move my mouse and click.
What about that Brazilian guy you dated for a while? You contemplated getting accidentally knocked up by him, didn't you?
That was a joke, but he was pretty hot, I say as I click the Brazilian box. And let's see, I'm also going to throw in Native American, Lebanese, and Israeli.
Why's that? Gabe asks, appearing amused.
Because you've got some Lebanese blood, I say, and I've always liked your face.
Gee, thanks.
He stands, stretches, then makes his way to the kitchen table, looking over my shoulder.
And Israelis are badass, I continue. I think that comes from living in a war zone rather than genes. Buckhead might not have the same effect,
Gabe says, sitting across from me. Maybe, I say, but I'm still keeping that box checked. And I think it would be cool to have Native American blood, don't you?
I guess, he says, now scrolling through his texts. But, FYI, there aren't a lot of blue-eyed Native Americans out there.
True, I say, but it could happen, recessive genes and all that. Now, what about astrological sign? You think that's important?
To idiots it might be,
Gabe says, knowing I read my horoscope on a regular basis. Come on, Gabe. I say, you promised you'd be my advisor here.
What do you think I'm doing?
He leans toward me, his elbows on the table.
I'm advising you not to be an idiot.
I shake my head and say, well, I'm sorry, but I just can't do an Aquarius. They're notoriously cold, detached, I say, thinking of Will.
You'd rather have an attached sperm donor? Isn't that sort of the point of using an anonymous donor instead of someone you know?
Yes, but I don't want an emotionally detached child, I say.
Okay, but zodiac signs aren't genetic, he says. Assuming you believe in that crap, the sign of your child is determined by when your child is born, right?
I laugh and say, oh yeah, good point. See, this is why I need you. Religion. I guess Christian, right? Gabe raises his eyebrows and says,
what about your Israeli tough guys?
Good point, I say, clicking the Jewish box, then deciding religion doesn't really matter to me at all, and clicking the all box. How about this one? Favorite pet.
Favorite pet? Is that really on there?
Yes, I say, reading off the choices. Dog, cat, bird, fish, reptile.
That's ridiculous, he says. Who cares? But if you're picking one, you gotta go dog.
I nod, then think of Pete the PT and his cat, Fudge, and check the cat box, too. Gabe says,
what if he's allergic to dogs and cats and can only have a fish?
All the more reason not to pick him, I say. I don't want my kids to have allergies. Gabe nods, then says,
okay, but have you ever noticed that smart people seem to have more allergies?
I laugh and say, you only say that because you have allergies. Although Adam Epstein had bad hay fever, and he was probably the smartest guy I dated.
Well, there you go, Gabe says.
Okay, I say, looking back at the computer. Next up is education. I want a college graduate, right?
As opposed to a dropout?
Yes.
But Bill Gates and Ted Turner both dropped out of college, Gabe says. Can you get their sperm? Ted's right here in town.
Come on, Gabe, focus, I say, trying not to smile. This is serious. How about grad school?
If you can exclude lawyers.
Right, I say, thinking of Meredith and pretty much any colleague of hers I've ever met. What about hobbies? I read off the categories. Musical, athletic, culinary, craftsman, creative, artistic, technology, and outdoor recreation.
Go craftsman,
he says. I can't tell whether he's kidding.
Why? Why not?
I smile, skipping this section for now, suddenly thinking that this entire exercise feels bizarre,
borderline preposterous. Let's see, I say, scrolling down to the final question. This one's called Personal Goals. They ask the donors what matters most to them. We have fame.
Hell no,
Gabe says, cutting me off. I nod in agreement. Financial security?
Nah, too risk-averse. You don't want dweeby sperm.
Religious slash spiritual?
Maybe, but is that one box?
I nod.
Well, I like spiritual, but not religious. You don't want to get a rigid, judgmental extremist.
I give him a look and say, not all religious people are rigid, judgmental, or extreme.
True, but you avoid those types if you don't click that box.
I nod, grateful that he's finally being serious. Okay, how about community service, or improve environment, or just a nice general help others?
Yeah, I like all those. Check them for sure.
How about travel?
I like that too, Gabe says. Adventurous spirit.
Marriage and family?
Nah.
Why not?
Because if marriage is his goal and he's donating sperm, doesn't that seem to indicate that he's not very successful in achieving his goals?
I laugh. This is Gabe at his absolute best. Funny and insightful. How about this one? To be happy. Gabe pauses, deep in thought.
It's a little simplistic. Verges on hedonistic.
It says happy, I say, not pleasure-seeking.
Yeah, I know. But is the point of life to be happy or to make other people happy?
Well, doesn't making other people happy make you happy?
I wouldn't know, Gabe says with a smirk.
I laugh.
But I like it, he continues. If I were you, I'd check that one, the travel box, and all the ones about helping others.
Okay, I say, nodding in agreement.
But Josie,
he says, putting his hands lightly on my arm. It's not unheard of for him to touch me, but it is unusual, always catching me slightly off guard. I look up from my computer. Yeah?
All of this is sort of bullshit, isn't it?
Why do you say that? I ask, although I have the same general feeling. I want him to put it in words for me.
I don't know. It's just, whatever the donor dad is doesn't necessarily mean the kid will turn out that way. Especially when you remove nurture from the equation.
I nod and murmur my agreement. He continues,
and you're going to love your kid whether it's a boy or a girl, or a fair-skinned, reptile-loving woodworker, or a brown-eyed, sporty, aloof Aquarius.
I smile and say, I know, it feels a little ridiculous, checking the boxes for a baby. Maybe I should pay up and just get to the essays and photos. I scroll down the site, clicking on the price menu.
Definitely. Let's do that,
Gabe says as I pull my credit card from my wallet and begin typing in the numbers. It feels a bit hasty, especially when I'm not even sure this is the sperm bank I will ultimately use. But I'm afraid of losing momentum, as well as Gabe's attention. Before I click the final button making payment, I say, you really think I should pull the trigger here?
This isn't cheap. Yeah. I do, Gabe says, nodding. I think this will give us a good gut feeling.
I look up at him and say, but you're always saying I have bad instincts when it comes to guys.
You do, Gabe says, smiling. That's why I said give us a gut feeling. Now, move over, and let's read these essays.
Chapter 12. Meredith. If you don't want to have sex with me, maybe I should find someone who will. Those are Nolan's exact words when I rebuff his Monday morning advances, and the first thing I share with Amy once I'm settled in on the white slip-covered sofa in her midtown office for my monthly appointment. The comment has been echoing in my head all day as I draft a response to an emergency motion to compel, prepare for a hearing on a motion to dismiss, and attempt to negotiate a global settlement on behalf of one of my top but least likable clients.
He said that? Amy asks,
leaning forward in her usual straight back chair across from me, looking the slightest trace appalled. She doesn't often overtly disapprove of Nolan, but I relish it when she does. It is my validation, an excuse to feel the way I do.
Yes.
He said it jokingly, I reluctantly confess, but he still said it. Amy nods, her calm, inscrutable mask returning.
And how did you respond?
I told him to go for it, I say, reclining into the sofa cushions. If he can find someone who wants to have sex at 6:30 a.m. on a rainy Monday, all power to him.
Did you really say that?
More or less, yes, I say, as I admire Amy's polished ensemble. Wide-legged cuff navy trousers, a bright white button-down blouse, and black pumps that look fresh out of the box new. Everything about Amy is crisp, uncluttered, smart. Her clothing, mannerisms, and advice.
Well, try to avoid responses like that in the future, Amy says, joking or otherwise.
He started it, I say.
Yes, but you don't have to play along. He just might take you up on your suggestion.
I shake my head and say, he would never do that.
Never.
Never.
Don't be naive, Meredith, Amy says. Pretty much all men, and all people, are capable of cheating under the right circumstances.
It is the sort of concrete insight that sets her apart from so many other therapists, and the main reason I keep coming back to her. She actually adds to the conversation, rather than just listening to me talking away self-indulgently. She adds,
do you know how easy it is for a nice-looking, successful man like Nolan to find someone who will have sex with him?
She taps her mechanical pencil on her tablet, the rhythm of a rhetorical question. I give her a little shrug.
Well, it's easy to be cavalier when you're confident nothing is going on, Amy says. But what if he actually had an affair?
She crosses her legs.
How would you feel?
I sigh and tell her that I can't fathom Nolan ever cheating on me.
He's far from perfect, but he's not a liar, I say, thinking that his flaws fall more under the heading of not doing things, not listening, not helping with Harper, not putting his clothes in the hamper.
Well, I'd like you to try to imagine it anyway, she presses.
Picture Nolan spending time with one of his more attractive female friends. Innocent at first. They simply enjoy a strong rapport, a genuine platonic affection.
He doesn't have female friends, I say. She gives me a skeptical look.
What? I say. He really doesn't.
Okay. Then perhaps a colleague. Someone he likes and respects at work.
Honestly, I can't picture anyone that fits that bill, I say.
Just as Diane West, our new neighbor and a recently divorced mother of one teenage son, pops into my head. Diane is a decade older than I am, somewhere in her mid-40s, but has a fantastic figure, an elegant sense of style, and an impressive career as an equine veterinarian.
Okay, I just thought of someone, I say, deciding to play along with Amy's game.
Our neighbor, Diane.
Okay, Amy nods. Tell me about her.
She's a horse vet. She also rides.
Pretty. Very confident. Comfortable in her own skin, Amy says, an expression she often uses, and one of her litmus tests for happiness.
Yeah, that's a fair description, I say, thinking that Diane also looks quite comfortable in tight riding pants.
Okay, Amy says, nodding as if we're finally getting somewhere. Her sleek black bob swings forward, then settles right back in place. So, one night, Diana...
Diane, I correct her. Somehow this seems like a relevant detail.
Right. Diane stops over to borrow a cup of sugar.
I laugh. Does anyone do that anymore? That's so 50s.
Please forgive my gender stereotyping, especially given Diane's remarkable career. Do you know it's harder to become a vet than it is an MD?
I roll my eyes at her transparent attempt to make me jealous.
Yes, I've heard that. Go on.
Right. So Diane drops by to borrow a...
Phillips screwdriver. Her washing machine is on the fritz.
Pity, I say.
Yes. So Nolan finds one in the garage, then offers to take a look. While you stay home with Harper, in mid-temper tantrum, Nolan and Dr. West depart together.
And then what? I ask, smirking.
Wait, let me guess. Do they have sex atop her broken washing machine?
Amy doesn't react.
No, not as far as you know, anyway. He simply returns over an hour later. Mission accomplished. The machine is all fixed.
Nolan's good deed of the day, I say, rearranging the loose pillows behind me and shoving one against my stiff lower back.
Good for him. Good for her.
All's well that ends well.
Yes. Yet you also notice that his teeth are a bit red, stained from a glass of Pinot Noir. She happened to have a bottle open.
Nolan doesn't drink red wine.
Fine. Then you notice a trace of bourbon on his breath. She poured him a glass while he worked. One for herself, too. She loves whiskey. They toasted the fixed machine and finished their lively discussion about thoroughbreds.
How lively? I ask, still more amused than jealous.
Very lively. He finds her work and her rapport with such large animals fascinating.
Actually, I think he does, I grant her. He's mentioned it more than once.
Right, she says, nodding. So then it doesn't altogether surprise you when Diane begins to drop by on a fairly regular basis, just to say hello. Always when Nolan's home. Often when you're not. One evening, she drops by with a book, the one she told him about. The one she promises he will love. She casually touches his arm, but looks a little too comfortable in doing so.
Amy cocks her head and bites her lower lip suggestively.
Okay, okay, I say. I get your point.
Amy nods vigorously, smugly, as if we've just had a major breakthrough, when what I'm really feeling is standard fair competition with another woman.
So I don't want my husband to cheat on me, I say.
So what? Who would want that?
Some women do, Amy says.
Why's that? I ask. Although I'm pretty sure I know the answer.
So they have an out, she says. So they can do the same thing, guilt-free. So their situation becomes black and white, and they can get out of their marriage.
Well, I say. I don't want that.
You don't want Nolan to fall in love with Diane West, she says. Or you don't want to get a divorce.
Neither, I say, firmly. She nods, then writes one word on her tablet. I strain to see it, but can only make out a capital D.
What did you just write? I ask.
Divorce?
No, she says. Diane.
Oh, for heaven's sakes, nothing is going on with Diane, or anyone else for that matter, I say, now full-fledged perturbed, which happens about once a session to Amy's clear satisfaction.
Why are you trying to scare me?
Are you scared?
No, I say, I'm not. I mean, nobody wants to be the fool, nobody wants to be deceived. And I like to think that the father of my child has more integrity than to cheat on me, or have some meaningless affair.
Amy cuts me off, which she seldom does.
Okay, well, let's make it a deep emotional connection. But they never cross that physical line. Both of them are too principled to cheat.
I'd still be hurt, I admit.
Is that what you want me to say?
I don't want you to say anything, Amy says, which for the most part I believe.
I simply want you to understand your feelings on this subject.
Okay.
Well, I would be very upset if Nolan cheated on me, whether physically or emotionally, I admit, just before I let the word but slip out of my mouth. But what? Amy's expression is misleadingly placid. But if he simply wanted a divorce, without an affair or another woman involved, I could probably live with that, I say, wondering why I feel so tricked into this admission. I remind myself that Amy is on my side, or at least neutral. Besides, she's a professional secret keeper, and certainly not in the business of judging. So you could live with it, Amy says. But it isn't what you want. I say an emphatic no. It isn't what I want. Do you ever think about divorce? What it would be like? I say no, not really. I tell her my thoughts mostly consist of how to get through the day. She stares at me perfectly still, a wax therapist statue. But if we got a divorce, I think it would be fairly amicable. I don't see us fighting over money or things. Over really anything, I say, talking quickly now, words spewing out of me. Except maybe time with Harper, though I would be willing to share custody 50-50. I think that's only fair, really, to him and to Harper. He's such a good father, and she loves him so much. I think she'd be resilient. It would kill my parents, though, and his, especially mine. Our friends would be shocked, too. Everyone thinks we have the perfect life. Once we have that second child, that is. I stop suddenly. Amy familiar with the controversy over a second child. Have you made any progress on that? She asks. No, I'm still not ready, I say. The statement suddenly ringing hollow and the word ready a farce. You get ready for a vacation, or a job interview, or a move. You even get ready to actually give birth to a baby. But do you really get ready for pregnancy, especially a second pregnancy? Or do you just take the leap and do it? As if reading my mind, Amy asks the exact question Nolan posed to me. Do you think you'll ever be ready? I don't know, I say. I don't think so. At some point, maybe. Is that why you didn't want to have sex this morning? I shake my head. No, I'm on the pill. I didn't want to have sex with him this morning because I didn't want to have sex with him this morning. Fair enough. But regardless, I don't think there's anything wrong with having just one child. Of course not. There are actually advantages to being an only child, I say. Certainly, Amy says, knowing a smokescreen when she sees one. I wait for her to call me on it, get back to the real subject at hand, and when she doesn't, I'm almost disappointed. Tell me what you're thinking, I say, knowing that it has nothing to do with the pros and cons of being an only child. Okay, Amy says, nodding, her hair swinging again. I was wondering whether you love Nolan. The question, veiled as a statement, is so simple that it catches me off guard. Yet my answer is easy, automatic. Of course I do. He's a good man, a great father, I say, thinking that we've covered these points exhaustively, along with our history. The fact that Nolan was Daniel's loyal and kind best friend, that he was there for me and my family, that now he is my family. Yes, Amy says. I know that you love Nolan and care for him as a person and a partner and the father of your child, but are you in love with him? I stare at Amy, feeling rankled over what, for years, I've told myself is an adolescent distinction. The fact that my heart doesn't race over Nolan, and I never feel overwhelmed by lust, and I don't melt when our eyes meet across a crowded room. Hell, I seldom even look for him in a crowded room. Doesn't mean I don't love him, or that I'm not committed to our marriage. Yet deep down, I know what she's asking me, just as I know the answer, and have since that day in the dugout. It is an immutable fact, the same as Daniel being dead. impossible to change simply by wishing things were different. So I finally make myself confess the truth. I am telling my therapist, but as these things go, I'm really telling myself. No, I say aloud. My voice is soft and low, but clear, and very, very certain. No, I am not in love with my husband.
Chapter 13, Josie. I've never understood precisely what Murphy's Law is, but I'm pretty sure it applies when I finally break down and go out with Pete the PT for the second time. This time to Bistro Nico, an upscale French restaurant wearing the same dress and shoes I had on at Open House, and spot none other than Will and Andrea Carlisle enjoying a cozy steak dinner. It doesn't help matters that Pete just got a self-proclaimed bad haircut that approaches a buzz, and is wearing a short-sleeved button-down shirt, the combination evoking a door-to-door missionary. Nor does it help that Will is sporting my favorite look, jacket and no tie with jeans, along with a sexy 5 o'clock shadow. As the hostess leads us right past their table, I avert my eyes, praying that we'll go undetected, but then hear Andrea calling my name over the dull din of diners. With Pete trailing behind, I stop abruptly, feign surprise, and say, "Oh, hey there." "Hey," Andrea says as I notice that she got her hair colored, the grays eradicated, her rich golden highlights fully restored. "Nice to see you again." "You too. Recognize the dress?" I let out a nervous laugh, regretting the comment immediately. Andrea blinks, playing dumb, which I find mostly kind, but also annoying, since I'm then forced to say, "I had it on the other night." "Oh, yes, I do remember it now," she says, nodding effusively. "It's such a pretty dress." "Thank you," I say, allowing myself a quick glance at Will, who peers up at me, his dark eyes shining in the candlelight. I can't read his expression, but his half-smile makes my chest ache. "Hi, Josie," he says, then shifts his gaze to Pete, now directly beside me. When Andrea does the same, I feel forced to make an introduction. "Pete, this is Andrea and Will. I teach their daughter," I say as succinctly as possible. Pete nods, smiles, and says, "Ah, nice." "So," Andrea asks with a girlfriendy lilt, "are y'all on a date?" I say no, just as Pete replies yes. Andrea manages to wince and smile at once. "Oops, sorry, none of my business."
"No, it really isn't,"
Will mumbles into his wine glass. His tone to his wife isn't exactly rude, but it is slightly reprimanding, evoking his subtle but pervasive sense of superiority, something I had forgotten, or more likely buried. I think of how he nudged me under the table when I said something he perceived as inappropriate. Sometimes he was right. Usually, it felt like needless nitpicking. The memory is a slight comfort, offsetting those damn brown eyes. "No worries," I say, entirely for Andrea's benefit. "It's sort of a date, but we're really just friends."
"Yeah, technically this is our second date, but because we had no chemistry on our first date, Josie's already given up," Pete says, trying to be funny, but making everything exponentially more awkward. "I still have hope, however."
Andrea nods earnestly and says, "Yes, these things sometimes take time."
"Was that how it was for you two?"
Pete asks, as I stand there in disbelief that this conversation is actually happening.
Not exactly, she mumbles, as Will calmly cuts his next bite of steak, raising his fork to his lips.
The opposite of love is indifference, I remind myself, but feel an intense wave of bitterness.
"Not exactly," I say with an acerbic laugh. "Not at all.
Andrea and Will got engaged very quickly, immediately after he and I broke up, in fact." I snap my fingers for dramatic effect. Pete laughs, then realizes I'm not kidding, his expression mirroring Andrea's, something between pity and discomfort. Meanwhile, Will begins to cough. The three of us glance at him with mild concern as the coughing quickly escalates to a disturbing choking sound.
"Honey, are you okay?"
Andrea asks. Will answers with a loud gasp, then goes silent, his eyes wide, watery, and panicked.
Will!
Andrea shouts, rising from her seat as the hostess steps toward our table, and the couple next to us begin to stare.
Will, can you breathe?
He doesn't reply, because clearly he cannot breathe, as Andrea yells to no one in particular.
He's choking!
She looks around the restaurant and shouts.
Is there a doctor? Does anyone know the Heimlich maneuver?
No, that's not recommended yet,
Pete says, holding his hand up to calm Andrea while stepping toward Will, intently watching him. He's in the medical field, I tell Andrea, hoping that physical therapists are trained in choking first aid.
Try to cough, Pete calmly instructs Will. Can you cough at all?
Will shakes his head, making a faint wheezing sound. Andrea continues to yell for help. I watch in horror, picturing a gruesome image, Edie standing beside her daddy's casket.
Okay, stand up, man,
Pete says, helping Will out of his seat, bracing him with his arm around his waist as he strikes Will's back with the heel of his hand 3 times in a row. Thwack, thwack, thwack. Nothing happens, except I notice Will's lips start to turn a tinge blue. Then, with the 4th hard, loud blow between his shoulder blades, Will heaves the stringy bit of red meat out of his mouth. It lands on the white linen tablecloth just past his plate. I stare at it, marveling that it could have been as lethal as a bullet to the head, while diners around us begin to clap and cheer. Will gasps for breath. I watch Andrea put both hands over her heart and rush to her husband's side, throwing her arms around his neck. He allows a brief embrace, then says something to her under his breath, before pulling away and sitting back down.
Oh my God, thank you so much, Andrea says, turning to Pete, tears in her eyes.
Pete modestly shakes off her gratitude and asks Will if he's all right.
Yeah, I'm fine. Just went down the wrong pipe,
Will sputters, before taking a long drink of water. As he puts his glass back on the table, I watch his expression of relief morph into one of mortification.
You can sit down now,
he mumbles to his wife, as I think how much he's always hated a scene. Andrea takes her seat, still profusely thanking Pete. I watch as Will tries to discreetly scoop the glob of meat into his napkin. It takes 2 tries, and, to my secret satisfaction, leaves a telltale stain on the tablecloth, almost as red as the hue of Will's neck and ears. Only then does Will reach up to shake Pete's hand and thank him for the first time.
No problem, buddy, Pete says. Happy to help.
Later that evening, after Will and Andrea send a bottle of wine over to our table, Pete begins to laugh.
What?
I say.
That guy really dumped you and married her?
Yes, I say. What exactly is so funny about that?
Well, talk about revenge. You almost made him choke to death.
I smile, shrug, and say, no, happiness is the best revenge.
Trite, but true, Pete says, nodding. So, are you happy?
I'm working on that, I say. Then lest he get the wrong idea, I give him the update on my single motherhood research, telling him all about my checklists on issues like finances, childcare options, health insurance coverage, and maternity leave. I then go on to tell him about the essays by sperm donors that Gabe and I spent hours reading together. Of course, we narrowed it on the basis of health first, only considering donors with a stellar medical history. Pete listens intently, then says,
do you have a front runner?
Maybe, I say, then reach into my purse and hand him the essay by a donor named Glenn S. that I printed last night. I watch as he unfolds it, raising his brow, and begins to read. I'm a 27-year-old straight male documentary filmmaker. I attended Cal Berkeley for my undergraduate degree, where I majored in communications and ran track, mostly middle distances. I am fit, slim, healthy, and eat a completely plant-based diet. My eating habits are a result of 3 factors. First and foremost, a compassion for animals and a desire to avoid contributing to their suffering. Secondly, a lifelong interest in health and nutrition. And finally, for environmental reasons, as meat and animal products are the number 1 cause of destruction of our planet. My recipient need not share my beliefs, but should be happy to know that her donor is both compassionate and healthy. Currently, I am working on a documentary film about the visceral reaction most humans feel when they see animal suffering, and the disconnect and rationalization they engage in when continuing to eat and wear those same animals. I decided to be a donor because I do not believe in the societal norms that mandate that I raise a family, nor do I want to contribute to the further destruction of the resources of our planet by having my own child. However, I do have a great deal of compassion in my heart for women who want to be a mother and cannot, for whatever reason. If someone is determined to bring a new life onto our planet, I would rather that life come from intelligent, compassionate genes. Pete finishes reading, his brows raised.
That's from a sperm donor?
Yes, I say, taking the paper from him and putting it back into my purse. My friend Gabe helped me select him. Pete nods, then asks if I know what he looks like. His baby picture was cute. That's the only photo you get, I say. But his description sounded good. Blue eyes, light hair, athletic, 6 feet tall. Pete smiles and says,
sounds great.
Something about his voice sounds fake, though, or at least hesitant. You think it's weird, don't you? I say, wondering why I want his approval.
No, he says, shaking his head. Not at all.
Do you like the sound of his essay? I ask a bit eagerly.
Well, sure, he sounds nice, very compassionate and principled.
He takes a sip of his wine, then adds,
maybe a little extreme, though?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I admit, because Gabe and I thought so, too. But he was the best of the bunch, and I like that he's not donating for money. Many seem to be, though they try so hard to disguise it.
Money or an egotistical need to spread their seed across the planet? Pete asks, smiling.
Gabe said the same thing. Is that the way you guys really feel?
I guess, kind of, Pete admits. Not enough to donate my sperm, though.
We stare at each other, an awkward beat, before he cracks up.
What?
I say.
Nothing. I was just thinking that your ex choking on red meat might be a sign to go with the raging vegetarian.
Maybe so, I say with a smile. Later that night, Pete and I leave the restaurant in a shared Uber car. When we pulled into my driveway first, he leans over to kiss me on the cheek.
That was fun. Thanks.
It was, I say, smiling at him. I'm glad you were persistent.
Me too, he says, grinning back at me.
I turn to open the car door, and he stops me with his hand on my arm.
Wait.
I laugh and remind him that he's paying by the minute here. He nods, then clears his throat.
Any chance of you inviting me in for a nightcap?
A nightcap? I say, laughing. You sound like my dad.
Your dad sounds like a cool guy.
He's 64. You sound 64.
Come on, invite me in. I just want to talk some more. That's it.
I hesitate and smile, wondering what our driver is thinking.
Surely he's heard this conversation before, though he's politely pretending not to listen.
Okay, I say, noticing that Gabe's car is gone.
Would you like to come in for a nightcap?
Well, how nice of you to ask, Pete says.
But I'd really rather have a cup of herbal tea.
I smile and roll my eyes, then say, and now you sound like my grandmother. About 10 minutes later, after I've apologized for how messy the house is and I've made us tea, we head into the backyard with Revis. The night is pleasantly cool, and we both murmur how nice it is.
The mosquitoes are gone, too, he says.
I glance at him, smile, then say,
are we really talking about weather and bugs? We are, he says.
We can do better than that, I say.
Come on, what do you got?
Pete gives me a serious look, then says,
okay, I was actually just thinking of that donor guy's mission statement.
Oh, yeah? And? He nods and says,
yeah, I have to say, it is pretty noble.
I know, I say. I don't think I could donate one of my eggs like that.
Could you? Donate sperm? Maybe, he says, for a friend. If I believed she would be a good mother. For you, I probably would.
He raises his eyebrows and shoots me an earnest sideways look. I laugh, but he doesn't. Are you serious? I ask, feeling the tiniest flutter in my stomach. Or is this some kind of ploy to sleep with me? Pete gives me the Boy Scouts three-finger honor sign and says,
I swear it's not a ploy. Besides, I totally had a turkey baster scenario in mind. Isn't that how they do it?
I nod. Something like that. I think it's a little more sophisticated, though. We both take sips of our tea as I wonder if he's starting to feel at all uncomfortable. Shockingly, I am not. Would you make me pay for your sperm? I ask jokingly. Or give it to me for free? I'd give you my friends and family rate, he deadpans. I smile, looking into his eyes. It's too dark to really see them, and I suddenly can't recall their exact shade. What color are your eyes exactly?
Hazel, he says.
I never know what that means. What is hazel, besides a trendy girl's name?
A nicer way of saying brown.
Seeing right through my line of questioning, he adds, anything else you'd like to know that you didn't glean from Match and our two dates? This isn't a date, remember? I say. And I think I have all relevant data. I have your height, eye color, profession. You seem like a nice guy.
I am a nice guy.
And, I say, you just saved a man's life, so you're sort of a hero.
True,
Pete says with an adorable full-on grin.
How's your health?
Good, Pete says.
I just had a physical. My resting heart rate is 58. Blood pressure 110 over 70.
I nod, even though I don't know what these numbers mean. How about your family's medical history?
My grandfather died of a heart attack at 59, but he smoked a pack a day. My other three grandparents are still alive, along with one great-grandparent. Healthy Midwestern stock.
Do you have OCD, ADD, depression? He shakes his head.
A mean streak?
He smiles and says,
nope, I'm pretty simple. How simple? Not too simple.
What's your IQ?
No clue, he says. But I took all the AP courses in high school.
And where did you go to college again?
University of Wisconsin. I had a 3.6 in a hard major, biology.
Are you athletic?
Decently coordinated. I have a good golf swing. I shoot in the low 80s. I played baseball and tennis in high school.
Varsity?
You think I would really mention JV?
I smile. Are you artistic or musical?
Not really. Is that important to you?
Non-essential, I say, deep in thought, studying his face, my eyes finally adjusting to the dark. He really does have a good bone structure and even symmetrical features, almost pulling off the buzz cut. I like his complexion, as well as the color and texture of his hair. And then there's that cleft. Let me see your hands, I ask, putting down my mug and reaching for them. He puts his mug down next to mine and shows them to me, palms up, then down. They're on the large side, but not so big that my daughter might end up with man hands. I nod and murmur, nice.
Thanks, he says.
I clear my throat and say, so if you were ever to really do something like this, would you want to be involved? The question feels monumental, though I'm not sure what I want his answer to be. I remind myself that this is all completely theoretical. He's not really offering his sperm up on the spot.
You mean with the baby?
I nod.
You mean like paying child support?
He asks. No, I say as adamantly as I can, thinking that with money comes strings, complications.
There would be no child support. You'd be the donor, not the father. You'd have no parental rights whatsoever.
I'm talking emotionally.
I don't know. It might be cool if I could take him, or her, to an occasional baseball game. Would you allow that?
Maybe, I say. That might be nice. But if I ever married, which I hope to one day, I'd want my husband to adopt my child. And then...
You might not want me coming around?
Maybe not, I say. Would that make you feel bad?
Maybe, Pete says. But it would be your child and your decision. I would respect your wishes.
He starts to say something else, then stops. What? I say. Tell me.
Well, What if you wanted me to take your kid to a baseball game, and I didn't want to? Would your feelings be hurt?
Maybe, I say, as I marvel at how honest and candid we're both being, so much more so than if we were actually interested in each other.